back to another episode of Between the Post. My name is Tyler Vaughn, and this episode is actually episode 2 in a mini-series with Coach Carl Dawazian. So for those of you that are just tuning in, and potentially you weren't able to make it last week and hear the first episode of this mini-series with Coach Carl took us through his 9 steps of practice. And again, just a little bit of background, Coach Carl comes to us from California, where he was the state director for California Youth Soccer Association, and I'm talking that is a big-time deal. Coach Carl making likely an impact on truly, truly hundreds of thousands of coaches and players. If you listened to last week, you probably got the clear theme that Coach Carl does so very well, and one of the main reasons that I was so eager to have him on board here creating a phenomenal podcast episode with us, which is his focus on the player. At the end of the day, I think we tend to forget that we're dealing with kids and we're dealing with soccer players that potentially developmentally from a, you know, just a growth standpoint as human beings, they have challenges, and we oftentimes as adults, I think we kind of lose focus of that. And it was so refreshing on last week's episode, this being part 2 or rather episode 2 of the first part of what will be this mini-series. It essentially is picking up right where we left off. So if you weren't able to tune into last week, or maybe you just need a bit of a refresher on the first episode of this mini-series, Coach Carl took us through his basic principles of attacking, basic principles of defending, what he calls the 5 R's of attacking and defending, and essentially those principles where you're breaking down what players should be doing in the attack mindset and as well the defensive mindset. If you listened to last week, you heard me stumble, mumble, and bumble through what was truly a phenomenal opportunity for me, myself, as a coach, to go through what kind of ended up being a wonderful presentation or coaching ed seminar where I was going through it, and I was taking notes, and I found it such an intriguing, phenomenal conversation. So we went quite a bit longer than we anticipated. We were shooting for, you know, an hour or so, and Coach Carl and I looked back at the end of the episode, and we were about 2.5 in, and that's just really a testament to his knowledge, his ability to paint the picture, and truly just the wonderful conversation that I was so fortunate to take part in. This is, again, part 1 of a 2-part series where over the 3 weeks, this being week 2, episode 2 of this mini-series, we're tackling essentially the 9 steps that Coach Carl has developed with other coaches. He makes it very clear that this isn't Coach Carl's 9 steps. This is the 9-step process that essentially he has gone through over what are more than 30 years at a director level, 30 years at the state level of probably, if I'm not mistaken, the state in the United States that has the most soccer players. So we're talking someone of phenomenal background, someone of a phenomenal perspective, and we are so very fortunate to offer to the listeners out there episode number 2 in this mini-series with Coach Carl Dawazian of California Youth Soccer Association. Coach Carl is going to basically pick right up where we left off. Again, he's gone through his 5 principles of attacking, defending. He's broken down the thirds of the field into obviously what are the defensive, the middle, and the attacking third. He has a great analogy where it's the green zone, the yellow zone, the red zone, and you're going to start to get another opportunity here of the gold nuggets that Coach Carl is just throwing around all over the place, and it is a testament to truly his knowledge, his expertise, and his, you know, brilliance of the game of soccer. I cannot be happier to go through this with you guys. And if you hear me kind of stumbling through, it is very very rare that I am speechless. But you know, when you come across someone with such extreme knowledge and such brilliance, it is almost infectious, and it is a bit overwhelming to a certain extent. That's what we talk all the time about this episode. That this podcast is a platform. We wanted at Renegade GK to provide a podcast, a platform for other brilliant soccer minds, coaches, with goalkeeping background, coaches with team experience, coaches from all levels, from the pro game down to the youth levels and everything in between. We want to offer this platform so that you, the listeners, can gain insight, knowledge, education, and benefit from what we're trying to do. And if you're tuning back into episode 2 of this mini-series, Coach Carl is about to serve it up one more time. So let's dive right back in. This is Between the Post with Coach Carl Dawazian, episode 2 of our mini-series on the 9 steps to planning a practice.
Well, again, I want to say something, because we usually, or people say, you know, Carl, what you're teaching, it just deals with children. I see players at the high school, at the college, semi-pro, and even at the World Cup level that make mistakes. Absolutely. And sometimes we need to simplify it and make this game fun for them by coming up with terminology that they understand instead of being fancy with our words and, you know, trying to show them how brilliant we are.
Right. No, I think you've hit on something that I as well have heard many times, and I think that not necessarily as it relates to what you're going through today, but kind of the ideas and the topics we're going through, is you're right. You know, it doesn't really matter at what level you are as a coach. In terms of what we're talking about here today, everything we're talking about today in some form or fashion either directly applies or just simply can be tweaked slightly to apply. But I'll go out on the limb here and say everything from coaching at youth levels up to high school, a little bit above and beyond, but in talking to a lot of people, they're dealing with these same exact things. I mean, they're dealing with everything you're saying. So that philosophy of what we're talking about today only applies at the youth level, I think, is probably the most bogus thing I've heard all week. And I think that everything you're talking about should be, I mean, it's applicable. It's applicable. You're right. You're going to see it. People are going to see it when they watch games this, here in the next handful of days with the World Cup. I guarantee you, around the world, people are going to watch some player do something, and they're going to think, how in the world did they do that when they're playing on the World Cup stage, right? But we see those mistakes, and it's just natural. It happens. So, no. I mean, I'm going to go out there on the limb with you and say, no, you're spot on with any level that anyone's coaching out there. You know, if we're being realistic, this is what's happening.
All right. Well, let's go back to running to defend. And we said in the defending third, we stop being fancy, but we pressure the ball. We stay between the goal first and pressure the ball second. Midfield third, again, what you're doing is you make a play predictable. And the way that you do it is by being cautious. You may want to attack the opponent. You may not want to do it and just delay them. But once you get into the attacking third, which is our green zone, which means go, we should have the most pressure on those players with the ball, because in most cases, and this is almost across the board, even in the pros, your ball players in the attack in the back are usually not your better ball handlers. So if we have our forwards put a lot of pressure on those individuals, there's a good chance of taking the ball away and having a one-on-one with the goalkeeper. But in most cases, what I find, or what I've seen in the past, is you find that as soon as a forward loses the ball, what do? Take a coke break, wait until the midfielder or the back gets the ball back, and they wait for the ball to come up front so they can score goals.
Yeah.
Again, going back to when it comes to defend, the team that doesn't have the ball, the whole team should be defenders. The team that has the ball, they should all be attackers. So again, going back to the three parts, defending third, everybody should be staying between, cautiously between the goal and the ball. Midfield third, take some chances, and in the attacking third, take risks and try to get that ball back.
Gotcha. Can you run through, I want to make sure we touch on the different aspects of defending again. So just as we have read, run to defend, and what, I'm missing one, aren't I?
Oh, you're missing three more.
Oh, three more. Okay, good. So, that's good. I wanted to make sure we've got in terms of defending. So we're up to read and run to defend. Good. Perfect. Perfect.
Right. The next one is the ready stance. There's your third R, ready stance. And the ready stance, as you know, most players naturally will stand with both feet almost parallel to each other, which gives the attacking player three places to play the ball, which is right, left, and between their legs. We call it a nutmeg. But what you want is the ready stance for two reasons. One of them is you want to use the sideline or the touchline as your second defender, even though you're by yourself. you want to use the sideline as a second defender, so your ready stance takes the player and forces him away from midfield over to the touchline, or it tells your player, the player who's covering, which direction you're going to force the ball. So the player who is in the ready stance is giving a signal to the other players on his team as to what his intent is, as to where they're going to try to force the opponent.
Right. So we're talking hip positioning kind of in turn as it relates to your hips and your body positioning, dependent upon where the attacker with the ball is.
That would be correct.
Yep.
So now once we're in the ready stance, the next R is reject advancement. Reject advancement obviously means you want to delay the dribbler as much as possible and hope that you have individuals come and help you out. You get a two-on-one situation instead of one-on-one. The key here is that you want to jockey toward the ball. Reject advancement means that you don't just stand between the goal and the ball, but what you also do is you make attempts at the ball, which forces the player with the ball to look down. As soon as they're looking down, they can't read the game, and obviously what you do is you have a better advantage of getting taking the ball away from them. You want to force the player to keep their eyes on the ball.
Now, how quickly, Carl, or how quickly should players be rejecting the advancement? So when we talk about, you know, you have run to defend, you've gotten your body, your hips in the proper position to be ready, and now you're looking to kind of close down that attacker. So that process, help us understand, is that a process? And I'm just kind of trying to lay it out there for coaches. Is that something, should we have players just as fast as they possibly can get a yard away? Or is that a slow process? What does that kind of look like for players and defenders?
Sure. Now we go back again to read the game.
Right.
Where am I on the field of play? If I'm in the attacking third and the ball is, you know, 80 yards away from our goal, as fast as you can.
Right.
I mean, try to put as much pressure on those backs as you can, because if you do get the ball back immediately, you're a one-on-one with the goalkeeper. If you're in the midfield, you might take a little bit more cautious approach. And if you're in the back, if you're in the red zone, then obviously you want to stop taking those risks, because if you go too fast at the opponent, all it takes is just one juke and they've got you beat.
Right.
So you figure out as a player what your abilities are. You know, do I run fast right now? Do I run medium fast, or do I run slow?
Right.
And you have to first read the game, and you need to figure out again what the opponent does. Is he right-footed? Is he left-footed? If the ball's on the left foot, maybe I put pressure on him right now.
Yeah.
If he's right-footed and they're on the left side, maybe I put pressure on him right now. Or I might just stop the pressure and just stay between the ball and the goal. It's, again, up to the player to make that decision, and we need to put them in situations where they need to figure out where they're going to have success.
Right. But I think at the end of the day, one of the things I want to hit on that I really, truly agree with you on, and I think so many people are finally getting this philosophy or this idea, and they're really pushing players to implement it, which are, you know, defend as one and attack as one unit, not necessarily as the, you know, the forwards, the strikers. They're attacking when they've got the ball, but they're doing nothing, like you said, when they don't have the ball. And I think that we have to fundamentally kind of change that mindset a little bit. And is that kind of what I'm hearing? I mean, and I know, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean, is that, in your opinion, kind of what some of the we'll try to stay impartial, but what some of the best teams in the world will be doing here in the next few weeks, over the next few weeks, is it's kind of the all for one for all mentality. If we don't have it, we've got to all go get it, and if we have it, we've all got to keep it. I mean, is that right?
Well, the bottom line, and I'm not going to mention countries. People that know soccer, they know which countries I'm talking about, but they talk about having all-around players, which means you've got field players and you have a goalkeeper. Well, all field players, when they have the ball, the whole team becomes attackers. They think as attackers. When the opponent has the ball, all 10 players become defenders.
Right.
And they need to learn how to do it in all the different zones, because you may end up on a corner kick being in the defending zone, even though you're forward. You might end up in the defending zone, and you need to know how to defend on that corner kick.
Right. So do No, that's absolutely right. I completely agree with you. So do we need, I'll say something a little bit provocative here, do we need smarter players in the United States to accomplish that? I mean, is it just the intelligence level of players in the United States?
No, what we need to do is change what we call the players.
Okay, right.
If you go into it, you know, goalkeeper, we know what that is. It's the individual who's going to catch the ball. And then we call the next line in front of the goalkeeper defenders. Well, what does that tell you? As soon as one of those players has the ball, what do they become?
An attacker.
Okay, but they're defenders.
Right.
And they've been taught to be defenders from 6 years old to 16, and all of a sudden they end up being in the attacking third. Most of the time, and I've seen this in the ODP program, is we have players who get up to the halfway line, and it's almost like a zone or a wall because they can't go on the other side of the halfway line.
Right.
Well, if you have players like that, you know, they're useless to us. You need players that are able to play on every part of the field at any moment. And right now you'll see, again, in World Cup, you'll see a lot of backs that are going to be scoring goals. Your defenders actually score goals. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? A defender scoring a goal. So we need to change the names. I know they call them defenders, halfbacks, or whatever, and then they call them strikers. Again, it goes back to reading the game. I think their names should be, first of all, the players in front of the goalkeeper should be called backs. Why backs? Because when they look back, what they see is the goalkeeper. They know that there's no one else that's going to help them or cover for them, which means that they need to be cautious. They need to be really cautious in the defending third. They can take semi-caution in the midfield third, but they have to be somewhat cautious in the attacking third, even though we tell them to go for it. In front of those players, you've got the backs. If our team has the ball, they become attacking backs. Attacking back means when you've got the ball, let's do something, let's go and try to score goals. If the opponent has the ball, they become defending backs. So now if the opponent has the ball, yeah, okay, now they're defenders. The players in front of that line and in behind the other line, they should be called midfielders because they're in the middle. They're in front of the backs. When they look back, what they see is a player or a teammate, they become midfielders, which means that they're a little bit more cautious in what they do, in advancement, that kind of stuff. Because when they look back, they see that there's somebody behind them. If their team has the ball, they become attacking backs. If the opponent has the ball, they become defending backs. Midfielders.
Right.
Sorry.
No, you're good.
They're either attacking midfielders or defending midfielders. Then the next group line, or what they're, you call them forwards. Because when they look forward, they don't see any of their teammates. All they see is the opponent's goal. Their job is to score. But now, if they have the ball, they're an attacking forward. When they lose the ball, and this is so crucial, and we don't, for some reason, get our players to do this, but when they lose the ball, they become defending forwards,
right,
which means they take all the risks in the world to get that ball back immediately, because if they take the ball back, in most cases, it's a one-on-one situation with the goalkeeper.
Right, right. No, I mean, I think that you have... I'm sitting here, I'm taking notes, and I've got my head in my hands, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's just, I mean, you're saying everything that I have seen myself, and God, I have to imagine so many people that are listening are thinking that's exactly right. But I think that we have got to get, you know, all of these players thinking differently, and it's not that they need to think differently, if I'm can correct that statement. It's more that we need to be thinking differently as the coaches. And we need to be kind of restructuring how we refer to these positions and these kids, and really rebuild the mentality around what you're talking about, which is, you know, the attacker, the defender, the zonal, the red, the yellow, the green. I mean, I think that to me, it's just blowing my mind because it's just so relevant and so critical. And I think that I've seen, it, like you said, again, this isn't Coach Carl's 9 steps to success here that he's just come up with spur of the moment. You know, I mean, you're pulling from fields all across probably the globe. And I mean, this is just so incredible. So I hope everyone is getting the same benefits that I'm getting. I mean, this stuff is absolutely out of this world. Fantastic. So I'm telling you what, it gets me so excited to get back out on a soccer field and start implementing some of this stuff. So let's keep rolling. I'm loving it.
Well, to go back just one more time, remember what you're doing is, as a coach, you are programming that player in their subconscious mind. And if you tell them that you're a defender or if you're a striker, they have a certain mindset as to what their job function is. But if you call them field players, period, and if you're in a certain position, if you've got no players behind you, you're back. If you're in the middle, you're a midfielder. And when you look forward, you know, to me, what you're doing is you're training that player to, no matter where they are on the field, they'll be able to function. Because right now we've got three lines and they play like three lines, where if you watch World Cup, you've got teams attacking and defending as a team, not as three individuals up front, or sometimes two or even one individual.
Right.
They attack as a team. Okay, so the last one is to regain possession of the ball. So after we get into our ready stance and we reject advancement, now we need to get that ball back. And the one thing that few players do is they poke at the ball.
Right.
Poking at the ball is just like a boxer, you know, you use the jab, right, to distract them from what you're going to do next. And poking at the ball means that you take your front foot in your ready stance and you keep making attempts to take that ball away so that the dribbler has to keep his eye on the ball.
So is it making, are you encouraging players in some form to make contact with that attacker? Physical contact, literally, making contact. So when they close them down, are our hands making contact? I mean, what's that looking like? So the jab, getting after it, I get that. So are we encouraging players to kind of make that physical presence known for the attacker?
It depends on where you are, what position you're at as far as the attacker's concerned.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If the attacker is coming towards you, obviously the ready stance, you know, you have to do more delaying and you need to do a little bit more poking. But if you're next to the opponent, that's when you do physical contact, and the law actually allows you to make contact shoulder to shoulder. And one of the key points here is, if you're doing shoulder to shoulder as the attacker is running, as soon as they're on the opposite foot where you're at, that's when you make contact, because you may put them off balance and it's legal.
Right. Gotcha. No, that's fantastic.
So when you're saying making contact, you know, physical contact is only if you're on the side of the opponent or the attacker. But other than that, I don't, I'm not big on players attacking or slide tackling,
right,
you know, or making tackles that take out the player's body, so to speak.
Right. And I guess, too, it begs the question, and what we need to be thinking through is, and I guess this is relevant because it happens all the time, we typically tend to say that the player with the ball is in control, but I guess obviously from a defensive standpoint, we're trying to gain control and dictate what that attacker does. So, I mean, it brings up the idea, I guess, is it all kind of depends on two. So if I have come in a little bit late, and let's say that I've got an attacking player, they're out on the I'm the right back and I'm on the right side, I've pushed them to the line, but somehow they cut in and now they've got that angle towards the goal. So I guess we have to be thinking too about where we are on the field, and not just the zones, but where we are on the field. Because if I've got them pressed up against the line, where are they going to go, right, in theory? So, I mean, is that something also we need to be thinking about from a coaching standpoint, and really more from, I guess, not a coaching standpoint, but how we can, through coaches, instruct players positionally? Does that kind of make sense? I guess I'm trying to introduce the philosophy or the idea that, you know, if an attacker's got the advantage and they've somehow, me as a defender, I haven't done my job, I haven't pushed them out to the line, or my hip positioning is completely off for whatever reason, is that just something that we need to be thinking about too, that dictates the physical contact, what we do as defenders?
The way I look at it is, if the team, or if your team does not have the ball and everybody's a defender, personally I think that the advantage goes to the defending team, because the player with the ball has to have double vision, right? They have to see the ball and they have to see the field of play. If you as the defender force them to just see the ball, if you're doing proper defending and they're just forced to see the ball, they have no options.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, I like that. No, I like the way you kind of broke that down there. That was better than I was trying to, but you hit on what I was hoping for. So thank you for explaining that. I appreciate it.
So now we've got our our 5 R's in attack and defense. It always starts out with reading the game, run to either attack or defend. In defending, it's ready stance, reject advancement, and then regain ball possession. And the big one, obviously, is tackling the ball. And I like the block tackle, which not too many players use anymore, which means that you put your plant foot next to the ball, preventing the player from going to one particular side. You use your back leg, and you make contact with the ball so that you roll it over his foot. It's not contact to contact, but what you try to do is roll it over the opponent's foot, and hopefully you go on attack while you have the ball.
Right. We'll ask you on the next episode to demonstrate that for us.
That sounds good. I'll demonstrate over the radio.
Perfect, perfect. No, I know exactly what you mean, though. That's perfect. I love that. So, I mean, we've got our attacking principles and our defending principles, and you've broken down the zonal, the green, yellow, the red. I love it. So now I'm looking at thinking about all of these different aspects, and yet I still have to plan my practice. So does that get us into the 9 steps and kind of beginning that practice and what we do? You know, I know we've got to pick a theme and we've got to go through all that stuff, but I mean, does that set us up for weaving in some of these principles into our practice? I know for a fact, you know, you hit on so many things and I wanted to bring them up, but I know you're going to go over it. But we have to be thinking about these principles when we go into planning a practice and how we can provide scenarios or create scenarios in our sessions to really emphasize these critical defensive and attacking principles that you just covered, right? So, I mean, are we ready? Am I ready now that I've got this down to start to weave them into a practice?
Yes. So now we get to the 9 steps, because what you need to do, like I told you much, much earlier, is you need to know what you're going to teach during that particular practice. Because most coaches, they go into practices, they've got their mind made up as to what they're going to do activity-wise, and then every time a player makes a mistake, they stop practice and they make a comment. The end result is the kids don't have much fun, but the coach gets a lot of activity because he gets to stop the practice and look important to the parents that are on the sideline.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to know what you're going to teach.
You need
to pick one theme. You need to say to yourself, today I'm going to be working on, and figure out which one of those themes. Forget all of the other mistakes that the players make so that you and the players know what we're going to try to improve. So when you start the practice and you do your demonstration explanation, and we'll get to that step 1 right now, is when you're doing your demonstration explanation, you tell the players what specifically you're going to make stoppages on and what you're going to try to improve during this particular practice.
Right. No,
that's... Okay, so... Yes.
No, go ahead. No, that's absolutely fine. That to me is just so incredibly important. It's just clarity, right? It's being clear. It's removing any misinformation, miscommunication, misunderstanding for players. It's going to make their lives a lot easier because they know, all right, I now know the coach is going to talk or he's going to bring up points around in this situation and scenario. So I think, I was just going to say that to me is so critical. I see it all the time happening in the wrong form. And I think that we assume players know exactly what we're thinking and it's just impossible for them to know that. So no, that's perfect and a brilliant point.
Okay, so we have our theme, and now step 1, very crucial, begin the practice. I know it sounds too simple, but the problem here is that most coaches, they don't have an official beginning to their practices, and especially at the youth level in this case. The kids don't know the difference in a lot of cases when you're mom or dad or when you become a coach, or they don't know if you're now the friend and when you become a coach.
Mm-hmm.
So an official beginning might be a team cheer. It might be a high five to everybody, but the kids need to know, just like at school, when that bell rings, class begins. In other words, from a playground individual, you become a student. In our case, from a child, you now become a player. And the coach needs to teach them, especially in the younger age group, that discipline starts now. When I talk, you look and listen, et cetera, et cetera. One of the biggest things that we have difficulties with our players, especially in the teen years, there's no discipline at practice anymore.
Right.
And I think it's because we don't teach that in the younger age groups. At the U6s, they should be treated just like the 16-year-old. Practice starts, here's our high fives. Now is a demonstration explanation. When it comes to demonstrating, I know a lot of individuals, they feel like they can't demonstrate the technique. Either have a guest person come in, or to me it's even more important and much better to have one of the children who knows how to do that particular technique do the demonstration and the explanation for them. In other words, you have the child teach the other children. What I usually try to do is I teach one individual to do a move, and let's say, and I, by the way, I try to get away from calling it fancy moves like Messi's and Cruyff's and Ronaldo's and all those other things, but I call that particular move to that child's name. So let's say it's Johnny. And Johnny, we're doing the scissor move, you know, the step over, whatever you want to call it. It now becomes the Johnny. Johnny does the demonstration and explanation. Johnny also helps the next player to do that move properly. So now I have two players who know, hopefully, how to do it properly. Those two teach the next two. Those four teach the next four. Those eight teach the rest of the team. So in other words, I prefer having the players teach each other rather than the coach being in charge. Because children, they have their own terminologies. Children teach each other a little bit better. Adults were intimidating, and a lot of times we talk over their heads, or we do the demonstration incorrectly. So hopefully this will give you an idea of maybe having your players do the demonstration and explanation, but take that player aside, make sure that they can do it properly, and then when they're doing their thing, make sure you also compliment them. By the end of the season, hopefully you'll be able to have every one of those children become your demonstrator and your explainer.
That probably provides a more of a fun environment for the kids, too. I mean, right?
Well, it's the same with the adult players, right? If you finished watching, I think it was the Euro Cup, where one of the players at halftime took over the chalk talk, and the end result, the adjustments were made by the players rather than the coach.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so at every level, I think that it's up to the players to maybe help the coaches out in what they are trying to get across, either technically or tactically.
And I think it's important, too, on that point, for us as coaches to understand and to acknowledge when that's needed, right? I mean, we go back to coaches. We tend to have quite large egos about our own skills and the control aspects of, you know, hey, I'm in charge, I'm in control. But I think that you're right. I mean, there are just times that I even can look back at, you know, from my coaching career and playing career, and thinking back to the fact that someone else said the same thing the coach said and I got it right, you know. And I know that we've done this before out on the fields, and players have been working with themselves and within their groups, and the growth, the understanding, the awareness, so many of those buzzwords, but those critical, very, very critical aspects of development, they somehow increase, and they're augmented by the fact that, you're right, players talk to each other a little bit differently than coaches to players and vice versa. And that's just the way it goes. So I think that we as coaches just have to do a little bit better job of potentially just acknowledging the fact that, hey, this might be a great opportunity for me to empower my players to help each other learn and to learn together.
Well, I'm sure you've heard that some of our teams, they lack communication, right? We've got the parents and the coaches on the sidelines who see the field in one direction, and they're yelling at the players, giving them instructions as to what they should be doing in the other direction. They can't even see when they're reading the game. There's no way anyone on the sideline can see the same scenario that the players see.
Right.
So for us to get instructions from the sidelines is ridiculous. You know, it's like doing a goalkeeper training and not being behind the goal, helping that keeper out as far as positioning is concerned. It's the same. You know, you have to be behind the player to see what they're seeing before you can give a decent instruction.
Right. I used to say all the time to my players when I was coaching more teams, we used to say that there is a very distinct difference between communicating and talking. And talking happens a lot on youth fields and probably pro fields as well, and everything in between. You know, we're talking doesn't always communicate something, and it doesn't convey a message, but we say, you know, when you're communicating, we hope that you're conveying a message. So it worked for me in the past, and it's worked for the teams I work with, but we try to get them to understand the difference between communicating instructions and supporting And obviously players, you're right, players have the only perspective that's probably really relevant when they're in the middle of a game and in the middle of a session, because they're seeing it from a different perspective than anyone on the outside looking in does. You know, we are all talking, I think, and that's what I've gone with, and I think that it makes sense, is that unless you're there in it, you're doing it. You know, look, it's a different perspective, and that perspective when we're playing soccer is probably the most important one, so... That's a little nugget. I don't have a lot of nuggets, though, Coach. You've got a lot more than me. But, I mean, it seems to make sense for the teams, and they respond to that. So I think there's a very, very large difference between, you know, communicating and just screaming. And you see players all the time doing it, and they think, you know, you get a look over, and you've got this kid smiling ear to ear, and you're thinking, what in the world were you just saying and screaming? But they didn't understand that, hey, listen, it goes back to what you said earlier. I think, and it's have the players understand certain terms so that they can in turn start to communicate that. And I did another episode before, and we were talking a little bit on the fact that at the younger age groups, we have to start to get players, and I was talking from a goalkeeper perspective, but, you know, there are certain terms that goalkeepers need to say, field players the same, that they need to say and they need to become aware of and familiar with, but they don't hear it until they're 15 years old. You know, so I was kind of touching on that, and I think this is... You know, gets into a couple other things. It's a whole different conversation, but I love the fact that you're kind of hitting on that stuff, and it's a really, really critical thing as coaches we have to think about.
Well, Tyler, it goes back to the team has to have a vocabulary. You
right.
have to have, and put it in writing.
Yeah.
Let the kids memorize what the certain word mean. You know, man on, what does it mean? Turn with the ball, what does it mean? You know, things that... means something just to your team, and it may not necessarily be the exact word of turning. You might come up with, as soon as the player yells grass, that means turn to your team. You know, what you do is you try to put in language that the players have to use in certain areas to help their teammates out, because
yeah.
they see what's going on and should help their teammate by giving verbal instructions that make sense that you've practiced. I mean, that's the key to it also. Is not only do the kids have to memorize it, but they also need to use it in practice all the time. It goes back to the buzzwords, push, peek, and place. Why are they doing that? Well, because we're working on a technique. Why not do the same thing to help each other out when the opponent is doing specific things?
Right. Yeah, no, that's perfect. You summarize that very, very eloquently for sure. I think that it's consistency too, right? I mean, it's consistency. We as coaches have to be consistent, because if we're inconsistent there is no accountability for the players.
That's the bottom line. You know, you're in charge, and you need to make sure that those kids get into a habit. The only problem is if they are with one coach for 2 years and use a certain terminology, and then they're with another coach in the same club who uses a different terminology, those kids are lost.
Right.
You know, so even clubs and leagues, they need to make sure that the terminology across the board stays the same.
That is... I'm not even going to tell you what I'm thinking, but again, there's another whole episode. I mean, that's so critical. I see it out here. I'm sure you've seen it. I know everybody that's listening has seen it, but I mean, that to me is just a huge, massive point. That is, we have got to think as organizations about that. And I know, not to get off topic, but I know there's a lot of organizations at the grassroots levels that are kind of seeking an identity, if that makes sense, that they've got some good coaches. They've got some really, really... what's the right way to refer to these coaches? But we've got volunteers that are really super passionate about it, but maybe they just don't have the knowledge that, you know, maybe some of us think we have. And we're trying to mesh all of this. And I'm working with an organization right now that they're seeking their identity, right? And they're in a phenomenal place to try to instill some of these core competencies, terminologies, and terms across the board. So I think that, you know, you've hit on something that I'm personally going through, and I think it's... Man, it's critical. It is absolutely critical. But again, I don't want to get off topic too much, but it's so refreshing, and I want this to, you know, that's what this podcast is all about, is it's you right now are validating for me something I've been going through, and I hope that that's happening for other people that are listening. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
I've always wanted to be a validator.
That's right. I thought us folks on the East Coast were just miles behind California and the West Coast, but thank goodness we're experiencing some of the same things. But I mean, no, in all seriousness, it's happening everywhere. It is absolutely happening everywhere.
Well, Tyler, if you don't mind, I'd like to get off topic also, because
yeah.
Something just came to my mind. It's after a player does something either good or bad, an awful lot of coaches, and this goes back to verbiage that we use. A lot of times coaches will say, good job, or they'll say, nice going, but they never follow up and follow up with a teaching point. Hmm. Why did they do, what is it that they just did good? What is it that they just did not that well? In other words, don't just say good job, but say good job because you locked your ankle, or good job because you used your eyes. Whatever it might be, use every single time that you get an opportunity to say something as a teaching tool. So it's give a compliment, let them know what it is, and make it nice and loud so that all the other players can hear it because you're teaching them at the same time.
Mm, yes, I absolutely love it. You know, I think we tend to forget what comes out of our mouth has an impact, you know, and so many coaches, they've got this, they've got a loud voice, right? And I'm kind of being a little bit sarcastic, but they've got a voice. But we need to remember it's how we use our voice and what we're saying at the end of the day that makes sense for sure and is probably the most important thing. So, I love it. And I think we have to evolve as coaches at every single level as we have to evolve and we have to give a little bit more, right? That's our opportunity to make an impact. And I think that, you know, I've seen it done well, and it's extremely impressive when it's done well. And it's an extreme opportunity to learn from others, too, in terms of the coaching side.
Well, it goes back to what I was mentioning earlier, which is when the kids are teaching other players, what they're doing is teaching themselves twice. Mm-hmm. So it's going to sink in a heck of a lot better than just you saying it once, them demonstrating once. As soon as they start teaching other players, what it does, it really sinks it in much better into their subconscious mind.
Well, have you seen in the past, and I'm probably answering my own question, but I mean, have you seen that when players are more involved with helping each other, or even better, when a coach yells out, Johnny, great job at, other players around them are thinking, wow, you know, coach just said great job to him. What was he doing? All right, he was doing this. Now I've got to be doing this. So doesn't that allow an opportunity kind of as well for players to not only to learn more, but to become more focused, I guess, on improving critical aspects and areas of their game? I mean, is that kind of what you've seen?
Well, that's exactly my point. Okay. Anytime that you make a compliment, make sure you let them know what the compliment is for.
Right, right.
And make it nice and loud with good instructions, because the other players want to know, how can I get a compliment? Well, he just finished telling you how you can get a compliment.
Yeah, wow, love it. That's perfect. That's a great idea.
Okay, so we're into step number two, which is the warm-up. And the warm-up is every player with the ball. And like I told you earlier, it's an activity where every player has the ball, and go to YouTube, you find anything that has no goals and every player has the ball, that would be part of the warm-up. But here's what's different about our nine-step routine. And here's my question to you, Tyler. What is the most important thing that we need to teach our players in our practices?
Well, that is a tough question. I would imagine in some form it's how to play together. Am I right or am I completely wrong?
No, you're right because you said it. But what else? What is the most important thing for them to play together? Are there any other important things you need to teach them?
I'm probably overthinking this because now you've got me thinking and I'm completely out of my comfort zone, which I dig, which is good. I mean, I guess it would it be from a soccer standpoint of awareness of the ball?
Okay, so we've got another point. Make them aware of the ball. What else can you teach them? And that's really, really important.
How to have fun? I'm digging deep here, I'm telling you. I don't know. Maybe I know. I probably know, but I don't know. So,
well, you probably do, because I'm sure you've heard most of your other interviewers that our kids need to play soccer away from practice.
I knew that.
If they don't play soccer on their own time,
right,
then obviously all they're going to learn is what you teach them in that hour and a half, and that's not where the advanced players come from. They take their time. Well, most of us, we lay out the practice environment for the kids. They show up, the cones, the flags, everything is out. And all we do is tell them, you go here, you go there. Mm. And that kind of environment, what are we teaching the kids? What do you think we're teaching the kids?
Oh, I would imagine it's just how to follow instructions. If do this is what I'm saying. It's already laid out for you.
Yeah, I think what we're teaching the kids is you can't play soccer unless there's an adult around to lay out the environment.
Ah, I see. Yeah. You know what, Coach? This is the worst part, is I think you and I talked about this prior to it. See, that's what you've got me shaken up. I'm over here taking so many notes. I'm just at all of the fact my jaw's dropped that this stuff is just so much quality stuff. I mean, we did discuss, I think, leading up to it, the fact that the time there with you, the coach, is such a small fraction of the time they have out there in terms of available time to train and to play. I mean, it's critical for development.
Well, Tyler, you're taking a lot of notes. What you need to do is give me your address, and I'll send you my books.
That's right. There you go.
A lot of this stuff is in the books, but not in detail.
Yeah, I tell you what. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. But, I mean, I think that's huge. That's huge. What are we doing if we're not encouraging? I mean, it's a generational thing, unfortunately. I think that they're in the past, and I'm just thinking back to my past and growing up. I mean, we were, and I was by no means any superstar, but we played soccer all the time. I mean, I think back to growing up, and that's what we did. We played, we practiced, and I don't know that that goes on quite as much anymore. Or if it goes on, it's very limited. You know, I think it is limited. I don't know if that's just a cultural change, a shift in the distractions that now players have. But I think that's critical. To me, that's something that we're missing for sure.
Well, again, I think that the bottom line, what it boils down to, from what I've observed, because like in basketball in the old days, and I know we talked about this before, but nobody taught us how to, the neighborhood kids taught us how to play horse around the world and all those other games. It wasn't a coach,
right?
And all of us played those games. And in soccer, nobody taught us, or nobody's teaching us, to actually play the game by ourselves. So this is where the warm-up comes in. It's extremely important, I think, to at least have these kids do this. During the warm-up, make sure that the kids have two cones. They carry two cones with them. And when you're ready, they're dribbling the ball amongst themselves in a confined area. Make sure that you don't go between cones, you know, in a slalom run, because that never happens in the game. As a matter of fact, what you need to do is ask yourself this question. Does it happen in the game? If the answer is yes, then do it in practice. If the answer is no, then don't do it in practice.
Yeah,
and we know that the kids never run through cones at any time. So the environment should be where they're in a confined place and they're dribbling the ball amongst each other and dodging and all that kind of good stuff. But occasionally have them again with the buzzword. Coach needs to come up with his own. With the buzzword where they lay down the cones. Now, I'm going to try to explain this over the computer here. But you start out by having the kids, and this is in the younger age groups up until about maybe 12 years old, start out by having them feet together, go to the right side, put down the cone. Put feet together, go to the left side, put down a cone. That size right there is teaching them later on to lay down their own goal.
Ah.
Okay, but in our warm-up, it also is for them to do the figure eight. And I call it the figure eight stretch routine. Now, I'm not going to go through all of the different stretches, but the idea here is this. Most of our kids or most of our players are one-footed. They're either really good with the right foot or really good with the left foot.
Right.
If you watch top players, they're good with both, left and right. Where does it start? It starts with the figure eight. Once they go around one cone, they'll use the right foot naturally. Once they go around the opposite cone, they'll use the other foot naturally. And if you do it enough times, I think that the subconscious mind is going to pick up, I'm good with the right foot, I'm good with the left foot.
Right.
But as you're dribbling, you know, different body parts, I mean foot parts, make sure that they do that. But one of the foot parts that I'd like to really have the coaches focus on is, if you touch the ball with the right shoe on the right inside, where's that ball going to go? And I know we're trying to visualize this, but if I'm touching the ball with my right foot and I'm touching it with the right inside, where's the ball going to go?
So it's going to go to your left.
Okay, it's going to go to the left. Would the opponent know that?
In theory, yeah, they should, absolutely. Yep.
As soon as you put your foot next to the ball with your right foot in the inside, it's going to go to the left. The opponent can read that. What if I take my left foot and I put it on the inside?
Going to go to the right.
Okay, so can the opponent read that?
Absolutely.
All right, but one of the things that we don't teach our kids, we use inside, outside, and all of that, right, is the sole of the foot.
Right, right.
I put the ball, if I put my foot on top of the ball, which way am I going to go?
On top of the ball with the sole?
Yes.
I'm thinking it's going to go forward, but I guess my gut says I'm not really sure.
Exactly, and that's where you want the opponent. That's,
right.
As a dribbler, you want that ball to confuse the opponent. You could go left, right, forward, backward. And we don't teach the kids, I don't believe, enough to use the sole of the foot. So when they're doing their figure eights, my preference is it's natural to touch with the inside of the foot. It's natural to touch it with the outside, but it's not natural to touch it with the sole of the foot. And I think after, you know, a few years of touching it around the cones with the sole of the foot, maybe eventually we'll have players that are really at the top level so that they can confuse the opponent.
Yeah, I love that. So basically, to break it down, and I know that we are visualizing it, but you did a phenomenal job of introducing it. So you're talking two cones essentially about 4 yards apart working in a figure eight, different surfaces of the foot, really focusing in on the fact that, you are controlling where the ball goes and you are not you're not providing any predictability element for what would be when you open it up later on in the training session or in a game for the defender that's defending you to be able to predict your move. Did I summarize that? Was that about it?
Yes. No,
yeah,
that was brilliant.
Good.
You should be doing this section.
No, you're kidding me. Yeah, no, trust me. Keep going. It's fantastic.
Okay.
No, I think that's here's what I love about that, Coach. You said we're kind of subconsciously teaching them how outside – I always like to think about things. How could I give – through this warm-up section of my own sessions, how could I provide I'm shying away from the drills, but no, I mean how games or circumstances, right, that I was basically allowing players to learn so they could hopefully do it either with themselves, right, as an individual, or with one or two other people outside of the field. And I tried to always do that. That doesn't make me a superstar, but I did think about that. And I love the fact that you're limiting the amount of cones, because we see so many coaches out there. You get a string of 150 cones. You got green, red, white, blue, everything under the sun. And I go out to the training session, or I'm walking by it, you know, as I'm heading to the back corner to do a goalkeeper session, you know, in the dark. But, you know, I see there's 400 cones on the field. And I'm thinking, what in the world is going on? And I think that simplification that you're saying, hey, listen, you don't even need cones in reality outside of the field at your house. You just need two objects that represent that. I love that. That's phenomenal. And I think that's encouraging players to do more with less, which is what we have to be doing.
Excellent point. And that's the bottom line, because the warm-up isn't so much, especially with the younger kids, isn't so much about getting physically ready, you know, for the practice session. But again, the whole idea is to teach these children to be able to lay out their own environment so they can play on their own. And I like what you said about the fact you don't need cones. What you do is you can use anything, you know, from cans to you name it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's phenomenal. I probably didn't always succeed with that, but that was something I did want to think about, you know, because your point is so true. It's so true. We're working with kids for, out there, I don't know, and at different levels it definitely changes, but you're assuming a 90-minute training session, so you've got them an hour and a half. Let's just say on the best day that we have players focused and engaged for, I don't know, I don't want to be harsh, but maybe an hour out of that. That might be harsh, but so you're talking, you know, I've got two quality hours of training with a coach every single week, yet I wonder why on the weekend I'm just not improving the way I think I should be. And I think that you hit on a point that is critical as organizations, as, you know, globally speaking, at whatever level we want to put a tag on it, whether it's U.S. soccer, I don't know, but I think that's critical. So we've got to encourage these players and these parents. This is where the parents come in. You know, we've got to encourage parents. I know parents are looking for anything and everything to get the kids out of the house, right? But we want to provide fun opportunities outside of the practice facility to improve, to work. Because if you're only working 2 hours or maybe 3 hours a week, there's a lot of hours that you're leaving on the table of opportunities to learn. So I love that, and I'm glad you hit on that.
Well, let's stick with that for a second, because you brought up something very interesting, and that is the parent also needs to know how to lay out the environment, you know, put it in the backyard. one of the difficult things that happens, though, especially with males, is as soon as they start playing against their younger child, they control the ball almost 99% of the time.
Right.
And the key should be that the child should be controlling it 99% of the time, and the adult needs to allow that child to be successful, which means they score a lot of goals.
Yeah.
And I don't care if the goal is a tree or a bicycle or whatever it might be, but once you have the environment in your backyard, figure out what goal to attack, what goal to defend, but then the adult needs to make sure that they don't do a lot of touches with the ball, let the child do it.
I think that you provided an opportunity now that I'd something that I'm pretty passionate, might be a little too strong, but I think it's relevant, which is we have to provide opportunities, and this might be my teacher coming back into play here, but we have to provide opportunities for kids to be creative, right? And creativity does not necessarily mean that, you know, kind of like you said, it doesn't mean you need an actual physical goal in your backyard. It means that you need something that represents it. Allow the player, the kid, you know, son or daughter, allow them to create the environment, allow them to create the goal or the representation of what is the goal. And I think that that creativity is something we need to, again, I think times have definitely changed, and that's okay. We have to deal with it. We have to continue to try to, you know, empower these kids to be creative, because that creativity, you ask them to do it on the field, right? We're asking players to be creative on the field, and I think if we're not encouraging them to do that off, you know, outside of the training pitch, I think that that's something that we might be losing out on as an opportunity to really, you know, encourage the development of a player from a creative standpoint. This brings us to the end of today's episode of Between the Post. This was episode 2 in our mini-series with Coach Carl, Carl Dawazian, a former state director for California Youth Soccer Association. Again, this is episode 2 in the mini-series. We have episode 3 coming out next week. For the first half, what we've been calling part 1, there will be two parts. So do not forget to continue to tune in to hear more phenomenal information, education, and experience from Coach Carl, who very clearly, if you've listened to episode 1 of the miniseries, episode 2, or even one of both of them, I think you are probably doing the same thing I'm doing after listening to this and having that conversation with Coach Carl. I'm picking my chin up off the floor because I'm telling you, he was just dropping all kinds of bombs of nuggets of information that I think that every single coach out there hopefully is gaining from his standpoint, expertise, perspective, a little bit of something new every single time that you listen to Coach Carl. We very much look forward to next week's episode, part 3, where he continues to dive into his 9 steps of planning practices. Do not forget, if you have the chance, to like this podcast, to review us. I cannot stress it enough how much it truly helps other coaches. This isn't about fame and fortune for us, I assure you. This is about hopefully putting this podcast, this information, in the hands of coaches that might be struggling, that might be looking for validation. They might have been doing it for what seems like forever and are kind of running out of a little bit of steam and energy. We hope this is a podcast that inspires, that energizes, that enthusiastically gets you on track and or helps you understand that, hey, you're doing the right stuff to keep on pushing forward. For coaches out there like me, when we have these conversations and we're listening to other people out there like Coach Carl that have so much to offer and have given so very much to the game, it's a humbling experience. I hope you feel that humbling feeling that I kind of have from being so very fortunate to have spoken with Coach Carl, and I can't wait for the next time he and I are going to speak on the second half. We are excited for next week's episode, and I hope you are. Have a phenomenal rest of the week, and we look forward to seeing you again on Between the Post.